really excited to introduce by phone, we have Amy Bowen, who is the Director of Community Relations at Harbor Health Services, which Harbor Health Services help individuals and communities achieve their full potential through access to local affordable services that promote health. And I think that that last statement there about promoting health is a key indicator to the depth that this organization works with their communities, and that if you look at the services offered, it really, when I was working in healthcare, we called it the social determinants of health, and it's all those other aspects outside of what we think of. We think of a doctor's visit, but there's also mental health and behavioral health and access to food and sort of everything else in that space that really impacts an individual's health, and the comprehensive list of services that Harbor Health provides really touches upon the how important the social determinants are beyond just being able to access a doctor. But Amy is an accomplished marketing and communications executive. She has experience in the consumer and business-to-business industry, including professional services, nonprofits, fitness, restaurants, and retail. And in setting up your bio, I have to say, probably the coolest thing is that you received the Animal Rescue League of Boston Staff Choice Award, which is
very cool. Did, yeah.
So with that, Monique, hand it off to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. And welcome to the Future Lab, Amy.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us, or having Harbor Health, and for having me.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate we were able to make this happen. And I'm sorry there were some login issues. But how about we'll start with you telling us a little bit more about Harbor Health and the history behind it, and which role that it plays in the community. I think it would be valuable for the students to learn more from a stage setting perspective.
Sure. Well, Harbor Health, the company, the organization was formed in 1985 when Columbia Point Health Center, Community Health Center, and Neponset Health Center, which are both located in Dorchester, merged together. Columbia Point Health Center was the very first community health center in the country. It was started by Dr. Geiger and Dr. Gibson, and they had this idea that they took from other countries where community health centers are very much a part of the community and are an integral part of the healthcare system. Their idea was, let's bring healthcare, accessible healthcare, directly into the communities where there just isn't any option for care. They were looking specifically at healthcare as a way to alleviate poverty. And Dr. Geiger had the saying that I think really speaks a lot to kind of the whole premise of why community health centers started. And he said, I'm just paraphrasing what he said, that it's been true for hundreds of years that the poor get sicker and the sick get poorer. And until we are ready to address something, until we do anything to address that, it's just going to be this continuous cycle of that happening. And so the idea with community health centers, it was giving people access to healthcare, but it was a means to the end of helping people come out of poverty. So part of sort of the interesting thing of community health centers is that it's not just about like treating and diagnosing. It's definitely about those things, but it's also helping people, like, why is it that you're having this problem, and really getting to the root cause, kind of those social determinants of health. You know, if somebody is experiencing diabetes and one of the options they have is eating better, well, why aren't you able to eat better? What can we do to really support you in doing that? Do you need access to food stamps? Can we help you apply? Do you need access to women, infants, and children? So really helping kind of treat the whole person and all their and all the issues that impact their health so that they can achieve their full potential and really achieve that good health. So Harbor itself was formed when those two things came, when those two organizations came together. Both of those health centers are still in existence. Daniel Driscoll Neponset Health Center is located kind of in the Neponset area of Dorchester, and Geiger Gibson, Columbia Point has been renamed Geiger Gibson, and it's still in the Columbia Point area right next to the UMass Boston campus. In addition to those two locations, Harbor has expanded into Plymouth, and then also on the Cape with a location, a health center location in Hyannis, and a dental center it's right now it's in Harwich, and it's just about to relocate to Dennis. So we have 5 locations in total. So there's definitely more about that I could tell about the organization, but that's kind of a general overview of kind of, you know, sort of that mentality that community health centers were founded on and the approach that Harbor takes every day.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Amy. And, you know, I think like looking at the whole person and also, you know, how can we close some of those disparities has been magnified through COVID-19. And so it would be great if you could share a little bit more about what you learned on the ground around those glaring disparities that COVID data have revealed and, you know, what you've discovered in the process.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, although Harbor, our health centers will treat that we're open to anyone with any kind of insurance or no insurance. Primarily, the folks that we serve, the patients that we serve are low income and uninsured, and 42% are from a racial or ethnic minority. And most of our patients do not have reliable access to transportation. They rely on public transportation. They do not have jobs that allow them to work from home. And they tend to live in high density housing. So all of those things definitely put the patients we serve at much greater risk for getting COVID-19. And we definitely saw that, not only just in the impact of the virus itself on people's health, but the impact of it on a lot of our patients economically. We also run a food pantry, a women, infants, and children's program. We have community health workers that help people apply for SNAP and MassHealth health insurance. And the demand for those services has skyrocketed. At the food pantry, we extended our hours, and we regularly see about 2 to 3 times the number of folks coming looking for services since COVID first really expanded and started to infect a lot of people in the community. So it's kind of both places that we've seen it so much, that kind of the social impact of it, on the economic impact of it, and as well as on the health. Kind of an interesting thing about our population too, so many of our patients have like chronic diseases. They receive regular treatment. We operate a recovery services program, which revolves around medication for addiction treatment. So many of those things used to happen in person. And so quickly we had to mobilize to offer telehealth, which is mm-hmm. basically video or phone appointments, which, you know, definitely is something has been talked a lot about how, the healthcare system is really adapted. We've been able to offer telehealth. And so patients can still see their doctor. They can have those visits. Which, you know, to some extent is true, but for our patients, not all of them have equal access to telephone, Wi-Fi, computer, private space, all the things that really make telehealth work well. So, you know, we've seen kind of the inequities that COVID has really exposed in a lot of different ways.
You just brought up like the shift and the changes to telehealth. It's something I've definitely noticed with my doctor's offices as well.
Yeah.
Are there any other changes that, you know, you've been seeing in healthcare that actually responded to delivering or expanding services that you didn't have before?
In some ways, telehealth has been... the reason we weren't able to offer it before was not so much that we didn't want to, but that insurance companies in Massachusetts would not pay the same amount for a telehealth visit. They would pay about, you know, sometimes it was less than half, sometimes it was about half, depending on the appointment. So it wasn't financially viable with COVID starting, it became financially viable, and really because, you know, of social distancing and really trying to keep people as safe as possible. So many of our patients are medically vulnerable. They might have HIV or cancer or some other chronic disease that really makes them especially medically vulnerable to COVID. So keeping them home as much as possible, but still giving them access to healthcare is important. It was really amazing for us with behavioral health, because so that's an area where telehealth, delivering an appointment or having a visit with a provider by video or phone is something that can happen. It sometimes can lend itself well to a really positive, like a more open interaction sometimes between a patient and a provider. And so that kind of expanded. So we could see where there was areas where it was expanding. But there is also, at the same time, there's certain appointments that just don't quite work as well. Like, people need labs. They still need to check in and get their blood pressure checked. And just having that equipment at home to be able to do that, you can't do that with a telehealth appointment. So, you know, kind of the adaptations we've had to make in the health center is having, you know, just kind of some basic ones that you might expect, having somebody at our doors greeting people, giving them a temperature check, trying to get the word out as much as possible. If you're having symptoms of COVID, call first. We'll have a separate entrance for you. You know, now that we're starting to reopen, we are trying to space out the number of appointments. We have fewer appointments. We're trying to space out those appointments so that people are waiting in their cars or waiting outside and then are called in, so that there's less waiting time in the waiting rooms, and just even just spreading chairs out in the waiting room, just adapting to all those kinds of social distancing requirements is something where we've really had to adapt, just the physical location as well.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit more about the actual physical space? Because I think that
sure.
could become like a real challenge as we continue to perhaps having to follow the CDC guidelines, as this might be something that we are experiencing more often in our lifetimes. Hopefully not, but it's possible to happen. And some of those adaptations might be here to stay. What would that mean for a hospital environment?
Well, so hospitals, I can't speak to as much. I mean, but for the community health centers, which is, you know, kind of that primary care environment, think of it as like a doctor's practice, where, you know, it just has multiple services that we offer in one location. So I think some of those practices are going to be with us for a long time. I think where, you know, we can adapt, we can make physical adaptations to the location, but where we have to balance things is with access and the barriers that our patients were already facing, in terms of getting to a doctor's appointment or getting to into the health center. We'll still have the issue. Many of our patients work two or three jobs. They have to take public transportation. They are living far. They don't necessarily live in close proximity to the health center. And so when you layer in all those challenges and at the same time we have to make adaptations such as having fewer appointments, spacing out arrivals, adjusting our hours, you could see how, like, the combination of those two things starts to add up a lot more. So it's like, yes, physically we can make those adaptations in the health center, but because we're working with a population where it's so difficult and challenging and there's so many barriers to getting in already, it's just kind of multiplying those a lot more.
Yeah, that seems like a huge challenge. And also, you know, just from a business model perspective, also difficult to actually figure out how to be able to run in a sustainable fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a lot of what has come up during COVID is in the United States, this business of healthcare, where you see, you know, hospitals were overrun with COVID patients. They were treating patients, but at the same time, they were furloughing workers. They were saying that they were going to have to lay off people just because so much of what made them financially sustainable was the more elective, non-urgent care. And you know, the same goes for primary care. I mean, primary care, there's already enough of a challenge to have people do regular primary care, to check with their doctor, to go to the doctor. And so now you're layering in, making it even harder to get an appointment, to get in to see the doctor. There's risks associated with doing it. And that's why I think you see so many hospitals right now launching campaigns talking about how safe it is. And, you know, that you really need to come back. If you put off care, you should come back. It's really safe. Because what wasn't challenging before is especially challenging for hospitals, that they have to convince people it's safe to come back, that that they've taken all these precautions, that these new things are in place. And for primary care, it's just, there was already sort of that, sometimes people will just put off going to the doctor, but when you layer it in, you know, 2 to 3 jobs, you can't afford the copay, you have to take 4 buses to get there. You know, it's just something that can get put off. And so there's just, it's like the challenges are really starting to stack up.
And have you also seen this reflect in the numbers of people that you end up seeing compared to, you know, prior to COVID, because it just starts to become so much more challenging?
I mean, at our Dorchester locations, we were starting to see a dip in visits anyway, and that we had a lot of theories about why that might be the case. But once, you know, when COVID initially hit and those stay-at-home orders were put in place, our recommendations were put in place, we definitely saw a drop in business, because really it's like you did in person or you didn't do a visit. But once the state said that, required insurance providers, including MassHealth, which is Medicaid, and that's a public insurance program that the majority of our patients have, would reimburse for patient visits for telehealth, there was a lot of funding available to provide for the infrastructure. We could quickly start offering those visits. And so our visit numbers started to go up, but we're way behind. You know, people need to have labs. Like, there's a lot of people need to have their blood pressure checked. There's a lot of types of visits that have just dramatically dropped. You've probably heard about how childhood immunizations, for example, are just falling behind. And now there's this big concern that all these kids are going to get sick, not from COVID, but from not having their immunizations on time. So, mm-hmm. Our visit numbers climbed back up. For telehealth, but there's a limit to what telehealth can do. So, we've been able to sustain ourselves, but, it's still like not necessarily, there's still a lot of areas of huge concern as far as public health.
What do you think in this situation is the opportunity space to actually redesign how healthcare is being offered or is being accessed? Because the barriers are not going to go away, like they're still there for people to come to the space, to access it. Now you have a trust issue that it's not necessarily safe to go to any of the healthcare environments. So how are we gaining that back? Like, what do you consider some of the opportunity spaces?
Well, I mean, I'm a big proponent of mobile service delivery. So I think there must be some opportunities to do that. And so I think that's one area, especially for primary care, and you can make it a little bit more of an individualized experience. Boston Medical Center, for example, was experimenting with having an ambulance and a provider go directly to a patient's home to give their child an immunization as a way to make sure they were staying on track with their immunizations. So, that's not necessarily that could be a huge undertaking, but there does seem to be some opportunities for mobile service delivery. I think telehealth is definitely an option, and I think just figuring out a better way to network some of the things like labs or getting your blood pressure checked, and just really having a more expansive infrastructure, and that's just like how Harbor might be able to adapt, or how other community health centers might be able to adapt, and just really thinking about the original premise of a community health center was it's a one-stop location. But maybe in the age of COVID, having that one-stop location, it might not work quite as well. Maybe it needs to be more of a network where you have your telehealth visit and then you can have a network of locations that maybe are a little bit closer to you. Maybe you're just like your one service or something like that. That could be a way to deliver, make sure that people get all the different procedures and services that they need.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had yesterday a speaker in who also talked about, you know, potential middle spaces and how, mm-hmm. you know, we may be not necessarily commuting as much in anymore. Maybe there is just
right.
more opportunity to not necessarily work from home, but work closer to your home. And so it's almost this similar networked approach where you're starting to have like different infrastructures in place or couple it with already existing infrastructures. I know that
right.
any school
right.
has a nurse, for example. So would that be an opportunity to experiment with that at CVSs or in libraries mm-hmm. or, you know, in already spaces that are existing as part of the neighborhood fabric?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's kind of that idea of the hub and spoke system. Instead of like having everything concentrated one place, you have sort of like an operational base, but you have like other locations that maybe are a little bit closer proximity, easier, more easy to access, easier to feel safe because it's a smaller location and you have a sense of like more traffic control of going in. So there's lots of different ways. I think the challenge of community health centers is that we just don't have the same level of resources that what some of the larger private healthcare systems do. We're federally funded, so there's a lot of requirements that go along with that. So, you know, kind of the idea that how we respond is very important part of how we think about public health in general, not just with community health centers, but just even looking at some of, the greater issues in the whole healthcare system are probably not even just the way we deliver services, but just like how it's functioning in the U.S. right now will probably be in order in the future as well.
If you had a magic wand and you would envision the future, right, what would 2030 look for you in the context of community health centers?
In the context of community health centers, I mean, I think the premise of community health centers is delivering care where people are, and I think that's really important. Just that where people are has changed so much, and how to best get in front of them so that you're decreasing that, everybody, regardless of who you are, has some level of inertia or concern about going to the doctor. The more you layer on top of that, working jobs, not being able to afford the copay, not having health insurance, all those things, it just makes it more and more challenging. And so, I think there is a lot of distrust in the medical system right now across the board. So I think all those things are such big challenges, and the more you can kind of get back into the communities and maybe spread out a little bit more, and whether it's through mobile service delivery or just having more locations or having a lot more support services in place to really bring people in. I mean, that starting point, that first touch point for healthcare, it right now is like, oh, I have a pain, or my kid needs a shot, or I'm having a baby and I know I need to get care for my kid. Those are sort of like the first connections to healthcare, but I don't necessarily think it has to be that way. And so, one of the things that I really appreciate about the community health center idea is that first touch point sometimes is with providing somebody help applying for health insurance or help with food and just connecting people and using kind of those social supports and using those a little bit more as opportunities to bring people in to getting healthcare, I think would be really important. And just that idea that you're really thinking of healthcare is not just like going to the doctor to fix this or diagnose this or treat this. Like that treatment is just so much more comprehensive than the way it's often defined.
Yeah, and that's definitely, and it's an interwoven system. And, you know, I think we're sometimes not paying enough attention to the whole person. Sometimes it's just really limited to one specific condition and to a one specific specialty. And you're kind of pipelining through the system, not always in the most efficient way, for sure.
No, and, I think a lot of it, ideally, healthcare should be about positive, you know, the outcome. Often there's like the business of healthcare that kind of gets layered in. And I think that's, you know, something that does need to be addressed. And if I had a magic wand and could do something by 2030, I would love to see more like this idea that we have this business of healthcare, that we have a pandemic and that we're laying people off from hospital systems. It just, that doesn't make any sense. And it just trying to work through, like, how can we make sure people can get healthcare when they need it, that the healthcare system is there and it's not going to fall apart at a time when there's like one of the biggest public health emergencies. So I think there's definitely a lot of work to do, not just with community health, but working on that whole healthcare system would definitely be beneficial to everybody.
Yeah. I definitely agree with you. I'm in the interest of time, I'm just keeping an eye here on the chat, and we are starting to get questions in from our students. So Elisa has one question. Talking about the future of primary care, is it possible to have more patients after COVID-19 that are going to need special care because they were not treated on time?
Well, it's a good question. I think if you mean people who will need to be treated because they're having continuing effects from COVID-19, I think there's a good possibility. It does sound like that there are some lingering effects or lingering symptoms that people continue to have problems with for a long time. I suspect that if it's not medical care that people need, there'll be a lot of mental health care that people will need. This has just been an overwhelmingly traumatic time for so many people, and I really, and just like the amount of stress coming from so many different directions, I don't think anyone's really experienced that before, and I really suspect that probably one of the biggest surges that we're going to see, and we're already starting to see it, is in behavioral health care.
Mm-hmm. We have one question coming from Connor. What do you think the best solution is to the issue with technology accessibility and allowing telehealth to work? That's going back to the concerns that not everybody may potentially have access or the private space to be able to take advantage of telehealth.
It's a really good question. I think, and the other thing that I should talk about with telehealth, especially for our patients, where a good percentage of them have a preferred language other than English. And so in an in-person appointment, we would have an interpreter or access to a language line on site. And it has, you know, I'm sure there's going to be a technology modification that could help with that language accessibility, where if you have a provider whose primary language is English and you have a patient whose primary language is, say, Vietnamese, for example, to be able to facilitate that conversation. I'm sure there'll be a technology adaptation. There's just not one perfect one right now, at least that we have access to. So it's a good question about what the ideal situation would be. One of the programs that I had started to work on before COVID was just the idea of, like, how could we make different things a little bit more accessible. Could one of the protocols that I had read about with behavioral health in other states, because there's such a shortage of psychiatrists across the country, in one state they were really championing this idea of telehealth, but the telehealth is not in your home. You go to an office where you have access to broadband, you have access to Wi-Fi, and you can have that a really good private conversation. So you're it's a telehealth appointment, but you have a location where you could do it from. So I think, you know, in the near term, there's probably a much better way to do that. But in the near term, even just having, you know, some more satellite locations where we might be able to offer that to patients, I think would be an opportunity.
It's also interesting when you mentioned that you would potentially engage solutions with office spaces or with workplaces,
right,
which then might become more of a regulatory question. As well, like, is it something that we are requiring workplaces to have? It's mm-hmm. not a nice to have. It is something that you must have in order to care yeah. properly for your staff.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, you know, that idea of having like a company town where there is a company health clinic, you know, it's kind of that idea where that you really have to have that kind of reserved space so that there is this telehealth access. I mean, a lot of companies will offer as part of their health insurance benefit that, you know, you have access to, you know, these resources through the health insurance company, but it's not quite the same as having that relationship, an ongoing relationship with a provider.
Thank you for that, Amy. There is another question from Jake. What are solutions to, you say, bring healthcare to people in places of high density where there is an abundance of patients seeking healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, what are some solutions? I think a lot of it is bringing it to that community. I think, you know, so I guess that's a good question, and I don't have a perfect answer for that. Like, what does that look like? What does a mobile clinic look like that would be accessible to somebody living in a higher density area? I guess the idea is that the more you can bring something to somebody, the more likely they are to utilize it, especially right now when people don't necessarily want to take public transportation. People know that they need services. I think that for us, doing that delivery in a culturally competent way is really important. You know, certainly in the beginning of COVID, where we were hearing so much from communities where they had a language preference other than English, they had such a chance. They knew they were sick. They needed a test. But when they went to the health center, there wasn't an interpreter available. And so, you know, it just really speaks to, like, there's somebody who sought out care, but they didn't, you know, there was nobody that could really help them. And, you know, there was definitely a lot of stories across the board where people were saying, you know, I needed a test. They told me I couldn't get one. So there's probably lots of reasons for that, but I think the more, if you can bring something to a community where you can explain in a culturally competent way why, you know, something is or isn't happening, to provide that care, to build that trust, that would do a lot to decreasing some of those some of that mistrust and some of those barriers to people seeking care.
Yeah, definitely, and it seems like a pretty basic right to be able to have access and understand of what is being said and
yeah,
why.
absolutely. And, you know, like, who knows what the situation was, you know, like, it could just be there really wasn't an interpreter available. So it's not necessarily that, like, there wasn't a purposeful thing to do, but it's just because so many of the everything is stretched right now. And so really addressing those things, like, if something's so stretched, we really need to look at to make sure in the future, you know, we're ready to respond. It's not just like there's just one interpreter. There's multiple ways that somebody can get services and get assistance. So I think just looking at all those things, like where there were gaps and really addressing that, it would be an important thing to do.
Okay, we have another question from Will. While researching innovations in healthcare, there were proposals that range from large-scale architectural adaptations to smaller innovations such as new shields for doctors and patients. Is either approach more feasible than the other in terms of time and money? Is a mixture of both necessary?
I mean, so for community health centers, we're definitely very, very stretched for resources. Harbor is a nonprofit organization, and you know, if it, we're not, there's not a lot that in order to make an investment, you know, that's like a really long range plan to raise enough money to be able to do like a large scale building project. So I think what's probably most feasible for us in the nearer term is really kind of those minor modifications, but minor in that makes the biggest difference in terms of infection control and helping people feel safe would be what we would be looking at for the most part.
Okay.
I mean, you know, we definitely want to build towards the long term. And I think right now we're just wondering, and it's sort of like an open question, is having where our physical locations are, particularly in Dorchester, where we've seen our patients sliding southward. They still come to the health center, but they are moving further and further south because that's where it's affordable to live. Is having a physical location, what the big, you know, like, is it something about that physical location that's the barrier? You know, it doesn't look as nice. It's just not as accessible. People aren't feeling safe there. Or is it just that, and so that making some adjustments to the physical location would be good? Or is it the way that we might think about, you know, how we're treating our locations? Can they be more mobile?
Yeah, thank you for that. One more question coming in from Thomas. You mentioned mobile services, and that kind of piggybacks into that in ambulances, which reminds me of my parents talking about how they used to receive house visits from doctors when they were very young. That's actually true. That was very common during my time too. Do you think this trend could make an effective return in order to treat more of the unreached communities even after COVID-19? I know this is more true in rural areas. Now, but it's an interesting twist for the urban environment, perhaps as well.
Well, and I think it definitely is for in Boston, especially where so much of the public transportation is reliant on buses, and taking multiple buses someplace can be several hour proposition. And it's just like, how realistic is that? If somebody has a doctor's appointment for a lab test, that's going to be 10 minutes and they have to take an entire day off of work because they have to take six buses to get someplace. So, I mean, I really think that even someplace like Boston, which you would think has like a little, which definitely has more options for transportation, even there, there's still other barriers to getting care. And so if you just make that little bit of, the biggest reason people pick something is because it's convenient. And so if you can make something more convenient for somebody and still feel personal, still feel safe, and especially when it's closer to home, it just automatically puts them at ease. And I really do think that that's going to be something that people continue to look at. At least it's my hope that they do.
I want to turn some of the questions perhaps over to Greg, who has worked in the healthcare space before and might want to chime in as well. And then Anne-Katrin, do you have any questions as well, just from a more architectural perspective that could be useful for the students as well?
Yes. So I think there's, and this has come up in the previous talks. I'm curious how you think the spatial configurations in hospitals or these community health centers have to change to accommodate at least the current social distancing and hygiene laws or ordinances, and how could the spaces stay flexible? So, and maybe the notion is that we just need a lot more space, but in many instances that is not feasible. Do you see a way to address the spatial conditions?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, so much... you know, you're trying to have as many exam rooms as possible, right? So so those tend to be smaller spaces. So I think that's a really good point, that just the more you can expand those a little bit, it's going to be something that's necessary and needed. I think that's where you kind of bump into the business of healthcare and the affordability of it is just that, you know, there's a certain amount of number of visits that people have. And if they have to have that space available, those rooms available, in order to accommodate all those patient visits. So it's kind of the balance of the two. I do think that there's definitely some things that could be done with the space within the health center. I think that idea of keeping it flexible, absolutely, having more separate entrances. Right now, most places, like a hospital has an emergency room and they have, you know, front entrance, back entrance. Right now, we had to, you know, not just Harbor, but a lot of other community health centers had to figure out an alternative entrance for sick patients. You know, just even figuring out something like how could we, you know, adapt so that we have an entrance for patients with symptoms, patients without symptoms, but still making people feel comfortable. So there's like there's an element of safety and infection control, but still making people feel welcome is definitely going to be a challenge within the physical space.
That makes a lot of sense. And I heard an interesting interview with a hotel management, a hotel chain, who was saying that they're not only sanitizing all the rooms and trying to come up with routines, but they're also leaving out spray bottles with sanitizer in them very visibly everywhere. So the guests feel welcome, feel not welcome, but feel safe there and feel like, oh, okay, they're on it. But it doesn't, what's in those bottles is irrelevant as long as they look like they're doing it. And so there's an interesting symbolism and sort of symbolic and psychological notion of what is put in place versus the actual measures that are necessary to keep everybody safe, which is a conundrum somehow.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, as you're talking, I'm just thinking like even just how you adapt the space to allow for more fresh airflow or even just airflow. It's just, you know, especially for some community health centers, like we have very old buildings. So, you know, that the windows don't open and the airflow there is airflow, but it's not something, it's not fresh airflow necessarily. So I think just even thinking about those things so that people, you know, if you can point to, oh, the windows are open, there's a lot of flow coming in. If people can just feel that there is like, it's not stuffy. I think that just automatically puts people at ease too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
My question was around, so given the vast spectrum of services that Harbor Health provides, what are the different organizations or the other stakeholders that you're working with to provide care and provide access to the community you serve? And then kind of a part two to that, like what might be some like new, interesting or different partnerships that you think would enable Harbor Health to do to access their community better or more individuals in the community that maybe community health centers aren't necessarily working with right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, it's in Dorchester specifically, where it's very culturally rich and there's a lot of different cultures and not having just kind of the staffing really to be able to kind of from a very grassroots perspective really connect with every single community. I think that's an opportunity for us, especially right now where we can do a lot more to tell people about the services, about all the support services, and really bring them into kind of that process of becoming a patient, getting support from the health center. I think that's an opportunity, and just really at that grassroots level, thinking about where we could connect. A lot of the other side of Harbor Health's business is in an elder service plan and working with the elderly and senior citizens, and so really connecting to those communities where they definitely are feeling a little bit more medically vulnerable and just don't have the same access to services, I think is another place that we'd be looking at. I think, you know, in terms of partnerships, I mean, if we could get a better transportation system, you know, that you know, like a partnership that for transportation, that would be a big one for us. And then a big one for us also is just housing. And just patients either who have unstable housing or, you know, that's all they have money for is housing. and just to be able to connect with through that and being able to offer alternative services to really support them and their health would be a good thing to do.
Now, Amy, to close it off, we have like one last question coming in from Leon, David from the state rep, Dan Collinen's office.
Oh, yeah, he's on our board. So.
So this is like a softball question. And how does Harbor Health actually keep its legacy and continue to lead as the first health center in the nation? And what kind of innovations do you do to continue that pool position?
Well, I think that the mission of community health centers and why Harbor Health was founded is more relevant than ever. I mean, the problem has not been solved. And so really leading on that issue, that here is a way that we can approach healthcare at a very community-based level, targeting all people, making all feel welcome, and looking at how we can bring that care to them. I mean, the original idea with community health centers, which seemed very novel at the time, was what you open a health center where people live. And so I think we just need to have like that community health center 2.0 where we're, whether it's mobile, whether it's more like that hub and spoke system, it's really kind of looking at how can we get healthcare to people where they can access it in a way that they can access it. And some of that might be telehealth, but some of it, we still need those in-person services. And so I think that's where Harbor and a lot of the community health centers, especially in Boston, because we have a really good, strong group of community health centers that is very collaborative and works together, and really thinking about, well, how is it that we can get services to people where they are and meet them where they are? Because not everybody, some people are really need help, other people are hesitant about it, and really figuring out what it is that they need, and really leading that way.
Amy, thank you so much for having been part of the Future Lab today. I know that the students were really looking forward to hearing from you. There have been questions percolating over the last couple of weeks as well, in terms of what healthcare is looking like and what needs to happen and what some of the challenges are. So, you know, we'll definitely keep you posted on the outcomes of some of the future scenarios, but then also on the insights the students create on a more concrete level, and circle those back to you. And I just wanted to say thank you for having been here, for taking the time, and a huge thank you for the work that you and your team are doing. This is important, especially during these times. It's always important, but you know, it's magnified now. So I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule.
Of course. Well, I certainly appreciate everybody listening, the interest in the topic. It's definitely one that I feel is really important, and I'm glad that other people share that feeling as well. So definitely appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Amy, and take good care.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. You too.